Hello folks, I'd like to welcome you to Labor Relations Information Systems June 2015 podcast. This is the podcast we call First Thursday. My name is Will Aitchison. Over the course of the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, never do quite know how long this is going to run, I'm going to take you through some developments of interest in the public safety workplace. This is one of these times where maybe the biggest development in the whole area of public safety labor relations has nothing whatsoever to do with the law. Instead, what it has to do with is the political environment that is surrounding, in general, public safety labor unions, and more particularly, police unions. We've seen this pop up several times in the last 9 months. We saw it pop up after Ferguson. We saw it pop up after Eric Garner in NYPD. And now we are seeing it in the wake of everything that is going on in Baltimore. And what we are seeing is this kind of national discussion around the question of whether police unions should even exist. And what's interesting about this national discussion, and I think particularly threatening about this national discussion, is it's coming from both ends of the political spectrum. It's not coming from the middle. You don't see people in the middle saying this. You do see people on the progressive side of the spectrum thinking that police unions are standing in the way of reform. It's sort of an undifferentiated reform that is being asked for, but they're standing in the way of reform of policing in this country. And on the conservative side of the spectrum, you're seeing just flat-out statements, from the likes of the Heritage Foundation and Reason Magazine and the Wall Street Journal and Forbes. You're just seeing flat-out statements that police unions should not exist, should not have collective bargaining rights, and should not have collective bargaining agreements. As I've mentioned, there is a complete absence of commentary in the middle, but there's an absence of something else that I think is pretty notable, and that is a coordinated response to this dialogue. There doesn't seem to be anybody out there whose voice is being heard, and I'm not saying they're not trying to get their voices heard, but there's nobody out there whose voice is being heard saying, wait a minute, police unions really exist for two purposes. They exist to negotiate fair wages and benefits for their members and to have disciplinary processes that are fair. Both of those should not be antithetical to good government. They should be part and parcel of good government. And police unions have participated in all sorts of reforms of policing in this country in the last 25 years. 25 years ago, we didn't have civilian review boards in this country. And we do in most major cities across the country today, even though we've had collective bargaining for police. There's nobody giving voice to that, or at least giving voice to it in a way that is being heard. And I have come to think that this is probably the major issue facing public safety labor. And it's focused on police unions right now, but you can pretty much be assured that if there are going to be legislative changes impacting the rights of police officers to collectively bargain, that they'll affect corrections officers and firefighters as well. That's pretty easy to predict. And you know what? That may be where this ends up. That certainly is what the discussion is in the editorial pages today. You know, there have been four columns in the New York Times, which tends to stay out of labor issues, four columns in the New York Times in the last 7 months on whether police unions are too powerful. And they've all answered that question yes. Two of them have been from far right-wing columnists. Two of them have been from left-wing columnists. But they seem to meet on this issue that police unions are too strong. There's not much really that we can do about that or any of this in this podcast other than to raise the alarm bell that unless something is done in a coordinated fashion, This may be a discussion that is being held in 2016 in state legislatures in a very meaningful way. There's not too much that can be done, but at the local level, I think it's time for public safety unions to push back, to have a meaningful public relations effort where they say, hey, not only should we exist, not only do we do a service to our members, we do a service to our communities as well. Just on a personal note, so you know, I've tried a couple times on this. In the last 6 months, I have sent what they call in my opinion pieces. I've written them and sent them to the New York Times twice, asking them to publish. First one, they just never responded to me. The second one is still pending. They take 3 days to decide whether they're going to respond, and we're still in the three-day period. I'm going to try to submit the second one to, if it doesn't fly with the New York Times, I'm going to try to submit it to other outfits that might publish it, maybe the Washington Post or, you know, whoever it might be. But it's tough if, you know, you're just a guy trying to do this. It's tough to do. This needs to be a coordinated national response. Okay, off the soapbox into a little bit more details. I wanted to let everybody know that the seventh edition of my book, The Rights of Law Enforcement Officers, has now been published. You can obtain it from LRIS.com. You can also go to Amazon.com and pay more money for it, but that's just the way Amazon.com works. We also have another book that I finished. It's a how-to book, a kind of a practical application book on collective bargaining for the public sector. This is not just for public safety unions, but for all public sector employees. It includes everything from how do you pick your bargaining team to what ground rules should you be considering, all the way through the various structures for public sector collective bargaining in this country and how best to get to a yes in the final result of the bargaining process. So that one's in the editing process right now. We should be publishing that in the next 3 or so months. Now into the case law. And there's one case I think that really predominates in importance over all others in the last month. It's a decision from the Illinois Supreme Court on pension reform legislation. A little bit of background on this. Illinois has a variety of public pension plans. Some of them are state plans. The case I'm going to be describing deals with five of those state plans. There are a lot of local plans as well that are, like, for example, the local Calumet Police Fire Pension Board. There are a lot of local systems as well. This case deals with the most populated pension plans in the state, these five public employee retirement systems. As another important part of the background here is that the Illinois legislature has been warned for almost 100 years. The first warning started coming in, believe it or not, 1917, so 98 years ago, that it was not adequately funding its pension plans. And these warnings have come from studies that have been commissioned by the Illinois legislature itself. These warnings have come from bond review agencies. They have come from retirees, from unions, from employers. They've come from every place they possibly can come. They've even come from the Securities and Exchange Commission that pretty recently criticized the methodology, the actuarial methodology used by the pension system as bearing, and I'm quoting here, no relation to actuarial calculation. It has been a disaster, that is political making, because the state, which funds part of these pension systems, They are funded by local government contributions. They are funded by employee contributions. They are funded by a state contribution, and they're funded, of course, by investment earnings. The state has simply refused to adequately fund these systems, in spite of 98 years worth of warnings. From time to time, the Illinois Supreme Court has been asked to rule upon the constitutionality of measures that cut back on pension benefits, and has clearly indicated that it's not going to take too kindly to those measures, those pension reform measures. And there was a time about, I think it was about 25 years ago or so, where there was enough concern about the security of pension benefits that the voters of the state of Illinois passed, as part of a constitutional amendment, something known as a pension protection clause. And here's what this clause says. It's only one sentence long. I'll read it to you. Membership in any pension or retirement system of the state, any unit of local government or school district, or any agency thereof, shall be an enforceable contractual relationship, the benefits of which shall not be diminished or impaired. So there is, in the Illinois Constitution, a heightened protection given to pensions. These pension protection clauses do exist from state to state. There's one in Alaska, for example, but they're not in every state. So fast forward now from 1917 to 2013. At that point, these five state-funded retirement systems had a total value of 41% of the funding that was necessary to meet their accrued liabilities. 41%. It was in 2013 and remains to this day the worst off state retirement system in terms of funding in this country. There were downgrades that resulted from in the state's credit rating, and there were threats from bonding agencies that unless the state did something about this huge unfunded liability, that its bonds would be reduced to junk bond status. And the Illinois legislature responded by passing what became known as Public Act 98-599. Let's call it the pension reform legislation. And it did five different things. I'm not going to talk about all five. They really don't. There's only a few that I think are really important. The first thing that it did was to delay retirement by 5 years for when people would be eligible to receive their retirement annuity. The second thing is it capped the maximum salary that would be used in the retirement formula as part of that multiplier that is used. And the third major thing that it did was to eliminate a cost of living increase, a 3% cost of living increase on retirement benefits. Once that was passed, a group of retirees and active employees got together to file a lawsuit, and it went up to the Illinois Supreme Court, which found the case to be, and I'm quoting again, easily resolved. And what the Supreme Court did was to strike down all five changes, all five elements to this pension reform legislation as violating the pension protection clause in the Illinois Constitution. Here's what the court said. The court said that the pension protection clause means precisely what it says. If something qualifies as a benefit of the enforceable contractual relationship that arises out of the pension systems, it cannot be diminished or impaired. The court, and I'm quoting from the court here, says, retirement annuity benefits are unquestionably a benefit of the contractual enforceable relationship resulting from membership in a retirement system. And because this legislation reduces those retirement benefits, it's unconstitutional. Now, the state argued, and by the way, you can go watch this oral argument online through the Illinois court system. You can actually watch the lawyers and the court debating the case. It was kind of fun to watch it. And actually, you knew how that case was going to come out just by looking at the questions from the judges. They were directing them all at the state's lawyer, saying, oh, really? Can you think that we can cut pension benefits under this pension protection clause? Kind of had a pretty good idea the way it came out. And what the state was arguing in that oral argument was, we've got such a financial problem that we have to cut the benefits. There is an escape valve from all of the so-called contracts clauses in constitutions, the U.S. Constitution and state constitutions, and that escape valve should exist with respect to the pension protection clause as well. We're broke. We simply don't have the money to do this. We don't even have the money to come up with a long-term plan as to how to do it. The Supreme Court's answer to that, and this is a very gross translation, was, you know what? It's precisely because of that argument that the voters of the state of Illinois enacted the pension protection clause. They didn't want you to cut pension benefits when you thought it became fiscally necessary to do so. Instead, what they wanted you to do was to act in a fiscally responsible manner to fund pension benefits. Don't come to us and say that you're broke. Now, phrasing it the way the court did, the court says this pension reform legislation, and I'm quoting, is merely the latest assault in this ongoing political battle against public pension rights. Through the legislation, the legislature is attempting to do once again what the people of Illinois, through the Pension Protection Clause, have said it has no authority to do and must not do. Now, of course, we've got this pension reform legislation declared unconstitutional. What next? Well, it goes back to the Illinois legislature that's got to find a solution to this problem, a long-term solution. That's not going to be easy. The legislature is in the control of Democrats, and there is a venture capitalist right-wing Republican governor, and they're not talking very much about these sorts of issues, but they're going to have to quickly, or Illinois' bond ratings will be in the junk bond status. Fascinating case, very strong decision from the Illinois Supreme Court. While I'm talking about financial distress, let's go down to San Bernardino, California, and the firefighters in San Bernardino. You may be aware of the fact that San Bernardino has petitioned a federal court for bankruptcy protection. The city has basically completely run out of money. A lot of fingers pointing in different directions as to why the city has run out of money. The labor organizations point to what they characterize as terrible decisions by financial decisions by the city council. The city council points to what it considers to be overly generous provisions in labor agreements. So lots of fingers pointing in different directions, but there's no question but that the city is in terrible financial shape. And all of this really started in didn't start, the seeds of it were sown a long time ago, but it came to a head in 2012. Let's talk about the firefighters in the years leading up to 2012. Firefighters had a collective bargaining agreement that ran from 2003 to 2009. Collective bargaining agreements in California are called Memoranda of Understanding, so I'll refer to it as an MOU. The MOU had an evergreen clause, and the evergreen clause said that if the contract expired and there was no new MOU that had been entered into, the old MOU would continue in full force and effect until a new one was put into place. And that's what happened in 2009. If you'll recall, the deep recession in this country started in 2007. And so by 2009, everybody in the Southern California area, virtually everybody, all public employers, were seeing the signs of fiscal distress, and so it was in San Bernardino. By the summer of 2012, the city simply ran out of cash. City of San Bernardino ran out of cash to pay its creditors and employees, and it had a projected budget deficit of almost $46 million. Now, mind you, cities and counties and states can't operate the way the federal government does on a deficit spending system. They can't just simply issue IOUs or issue bonds, which kind of like IOUs, and say, we'll pay you back later. Instead, they have to have balanced budgets. And for a city the size of San Bernardino, a $46 million budget deficit, I mean, it's just really, it's astonishing. In August of 2012, the city filed a Chapter 9 bankruptcy petition in federal court. And a few days later, it started passing a series of personnel and labor ordinances, doing things like eliminating sick leave and vacation cash outs and sellbacks of unused leave time and the like. The city also contacted the Firefighters Union, and this is Local 891 of the IAFF, and in particular contacted the local's labor negotiator, a fellow by the name of Corey Glaive. Glaive and what the city wanted was to negotiate a new MOU. And obviously the city was going to be coming for cutbacks with the new MOU. Glaive responded that unless the city was willing to reverse those measures that it passed right after it filed the bankruptcy petition, those measures cutting back on leave sellbacks and all of that sort of stuff, unless the city was willing to reverse those, Glaive said, we're not willing to meet. His words were, a meeting is, quote, really just a waste of time, money, and resources for both the city and Local 891. The city goes out, hires a new labor attorney to handle labor negotiations, and new lawyer contacts Glaive, says, look, we want a bargain. Glaive reiterates Local 891's position that a retraction of the cost-saving measures was a precondition to negotiations. Eventually, they do get together. The two parties do get together. They get together in mediation, but the city's financial situation continues to spiral out of control. And in February of 2013, the City Council implements a resolution that imposed what were referred to as interim terms and conditions of employment for Local 891. That's February of 2013. A month later, the city is back in bankruptcy court, trying to get the bankruptcy court to void what it had imposed, to reject the MOU and to set aside the resolution. And the city's reason for doing it is it's even worse. We not only don't we have enough money, every day it's getting worse, and we can't even live up to the terms of an MOU that we agreed to a month ago, or that we imposed a month ago. The city then petitions the court to overturn, tear up the MOU, which will result in the city being able to eventually, under California law, impose it whatever terms and conditions of employment, including wages and hours of work, that it wants to do. Local 891 fights that, and opposes the petition in bankruptcy court, and that's what gives us this court decision. And the court grants the city's request to set aside the MOU. The court found that the city made reasonable efforts to negotiate a voluntary modification, and it was harshly critical of Glaive's response, this response that, hey, you've got to undo those cost-saving measures before we'll even talk to you. The court points to the city's dire financial situation, this $46 million deficit, and the fact that the police and fire departments account for 72% of the city's annual general fund budget. And the court had some really harsh words, some of the harshest words I've seen in a court's opinion in a long time, had some harsh words directed at Local 891. It repeatedly uses arguments or phrases like the Local 891's arguments are flawed. Local 891 does not understand how the bankruptcy process works. And it culminates, the court's opinion culminates with this phrase, Local 891 has the audacity to now claim there's not enough evidence that the MOU was a financial burden. Any financial obligation, says the court, for an insolvent debtor is a burden, which is why a debtor seeks bankruptcy protection in the first place. The last argument Local 891 made was that the city should have sought bigger cuts from the other labor organizations before it turned to the firefighters. And the court's answer was that's just simply not the law. All debts are on the table in a bankruptcy proceeding, and it doesn't matter that the debtor, in this case the city of San Bernardino, isn't as aggressively pursuing another creditor before it can put tearing up a collective bargaining agreement on the table. Well, that was the court's decision. That was in early May or mid-May of 2015. There's been a lot that's happened since then. Since then, the city publicly announced its intention to consider closing the fire department and to contract with another entity to provide fire protection services. It had a desired suitor, the state of California, which has a huge fire department, but the state told the city it wasn't interested in contracting with the city. Go figure, right? And the city is now solicited kind of statements of interest in subcontracting its entire fire department. Two local fire departments have said we're interested, and get this, one private company. This would be one of the largest, if the city goes that route, one of the largest privatizations of a fire department in the country. Maybe the largest. I don't know of a larger one. Just hedging my bet, saying one of the largest ones. And at the time I'm recording this, the decision as to which way the city is going to go, is it going to eliminate its fire department? And if so, is it going to privatize as opposed to contract with one of these local fire departments? That decision is still pending. Big, big case out of San Bernardino. And it shows that if a governmental body, if a city, this particularly arises under for municipalities, if it is in dire enough fiscal straits, that it's going to have a lot of leverage in the bankruptcy process. And while I'm talking about collective bargaining agreements, I always like these kind of not so subtle segues here. While I'm talking about collective bargaining agreements, let's go down to Florida and kind of a fascinating case out of Lee County, Florida, and the deputy sheriffs in Lee County. There's a fellow down there, the sheriff, his name is Mike Scott. He's a very, I think the word notorious can apply to Scott, notorious political figure who's made a bunch of statements where you kind of, you know, you look over your shoulder and you say, really? No matter what political stripe you are, I think you would probably have that reaction. But he's popular in Lee County. He's been reelected. One of his political positions is he doesn't like unions, and he in particular doesn't think that his deputy sheriffs should be members of a union. And for years, Lee County was, I think, the largest non-unionized sheriff's department in Florida. Scott had been very successful in convincing his deputies not to unionize. In 2009, though, the deputies were considering unionizing. Scott vigorously campaigned against the formation of the union and uttered the very memorable comment, at least in Florida, and Of course, he uttered it in an email, so it's thoughtfully preserved for all of us. He said, "I am reminded of a popular saying," talking about unionization, "pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered." Now, I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles. I don't even understand that saying. That wasn't part of our local neighborhood dialect. But I think it's pretty negative. It sounds pretty negative. All right, so that was in 2009. 2011, the deputies elect, certify, through Florida's Public Employment Relations Commission, a union. It's the International Union of Police Associations, IUPA, which we haven't really seen much of on the national level outside of Florida in some time. IUPA used to have a bunch of locals in Ohio, and they were kind of scattered in various places around the country, but in recent years, they seem to have been concentrating a lot of their efforts down in Florida. And at any rate, they are successful in convincing the deputies to certify IUPA as their bargaining representative. They sit down, begin negotiating a contract. The county's bargaining team includes Sheriff Scott's in-house counsel and two captains that Scott appointed to represent him in bargaining. As you might expect, bargaining wasn't an easy process. It took years. And finally, a tentative agreement was reached on all open issues on January 27, 2014. It took 3 years to bargain a collective bargaining agreement. However, that was a short-lived reprieve, because that tentative agreement completely fell apart when Scott and his representatives attempted to make over 200 changes to the tentative agreement and eventually refused to sign the collective bargaining agreement. IUPA responds by filing an unfair labor practice complaint against Scott, saying he refused to bargain in good faith. That goes before the Florida Public Employment Relations Commission, and PERC says, "Scott, you failed to bargain in good faith. You must sign the contract." Orders the sheriff to initial all the tentative agreements and sign the January 27th collective bargaining agreement. And it is angry enough at Scott that it also orders him to pay IUPA's attorney's fees. What's up with PERC's decision? What is PERC saying here? PERC is saying, look, what you really have to consider is the background. And the background here is Scott came to the bargaining table pretty much unwilling to agree to anything. For his position that was publicly stated was he would not sign a collective bargaining agreement unless it matched up word for word with the policy and procedures manual of the sheriff's office. And when Scott comes to us now and says he's not willing to sign the contract, what he is saying is that the bargaining team, the tentative agreement that his bargaining team agreed to, contained vague language, and it was necessary to clarify that language in places where it conflicted with sheriff's office policies. So in other words, the tentative agreement reached at the bargaining table didn't end up matching with the policies and procedures, and therefore Scott wanted to back out of it. And PERC says that's not permitted. Florida law requires that any collective bargaining agreement reached by negotiators shall be reduced to writing, and such agreement shall be signed by the chief executive officer and the union. There's no question, says PERC, that an agreement was reached here. Scott has to sign it. PERC is particularly tough on Scott's arguments that his negotiators, in essence, didn't do their job. PERC says, "Hey, look, Scott, you appointed them. You picked your lawyer, your in-house counsel. You picked two captains. Don't come to us and tell us that you need 200 changes in a tentative agreement that your lawyers and your captains agreed to. That's not going to cut it. While I'm talking about the South, there's another one of those segues for you. I want to move up to North Carolina and talk about a concept that I think is going to be foreign to most of you, at least in terms of the immediacy of its impact on your work lives. And that concept is political patronage. Political patronage used to be, of course, the way of life in the public sector in this country. In the 1800s, you were hired or fired depending upon your political allegiance to a mayor, to the county board of commissioners, whoever it might be. Political patronage has been largely done away with in this country. Largely, not completely. And it's been done away with by two developments. The first is, of course, the development of collective bargaining, because collective bargaining agreements don't allow for political patronage. And the second was the development of civil service systems that were, in many cases, adopted particularly to put political patronage out of business. So in most places in this country, the notion that, and I'm going to be talking about a sheriff here, the notion that when a new sheriff takes over, he can fire every single member of the sheriff's department and bring in his or her pals, the notion that that can happen is going to be foreign to you. Because in most places, it can't happen. But guess what? It can happen in North Carolina. This is a case involving Terry Young, who's a deputy sheriff, just a regular old deputy sheriff, employed by Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. Now, Mecklenburg County is a large county. There are approximately 1,350 employees in the sheriff's office. In June 2009, the sheriff, his name is Daniel Bailey, sent a letter to all 1,350 employees announcing his candidacy for re-election and stating that he'd like it if they'd give him some campaign contributions. Young didn't contribute to Bailey's re-election campaign, and she also made another mistake. She didn't volunteer for his campaign. Bailey was re-elected in November of 2010 and promptly fired Young and others who he did not consider to be adequate supporters of him. Young sues the county and Bailey. She's not part of the civil service system. She's not part of collective bargaining. This is North Carolina, after all. What can she sue under? She sues under the First Amendment to the Constitution, saying, I'm being fired, in essence, for refusing to engage in political activity. And that is impermissible under the First Amendment. And her case goes up to the North Carolina Court of Appeals, which rejects her lawsuit. The court says, yeah, it's true. The First Amendment generally bars the firing of public employees solely for reasons of their political affiliation. However, says the North Carolina Court of Appeals, there are some old Supreme Court decisions that are still good law, and this is right, by the way, that stand for the proposition that there's a narrow exception to the ban on political patronage under the First Amendment. And that narrow exception, in the words of the U.S. Supreme Court, exists to, and I'm quoting, give effect to the democratic process by allowing patronage dismissals of those public employees occupying policymaker positions. So in other words, if your job is that of a policymaker, and I'll get to that in just a moment, if you're at the level of being a policymaker, you can be fired for political reasons without a First Amendment violation. So who's a policymaker? Well, if you look around the country, you see some of these policymaker cases in sheriff's departments. Not often. They don't come up much anymore. But you see some of them still. And most often, the line seems to be drawn somewhere around lieutenant or captain in rank order. that you get someone who's up at the, certainly at the captain level, you know, the undersheriff level, whatever that might be, that person's more likely to be considered a policymaker for purposes of this rule. Most courts have held that even sergeants are not policymakers and deputy sheriffs are not. However, we're in North Carolina, and North Carolina has held for many years that the office of deputy sheriff is a policymaker. Here's what the court says, and please try not to roll your eyes when you hear this. In North Carolina, the office of deputy sheriff is that of a policymaker. Deputy sheriffs are the alter ego of the sheriff. Deputy sheriffs implement the sheriff's policies, are part of the sheriff's core group of advisors, exercise significant discretion, foster public confidence in law enforcement, are expected to provide the sheriff with truthful and accurate information, are general agents of the sheriff, therefore they are policymakers. Does that sound right to you, by the way? Does it sound right to you that just a rank-and-file deputy sheriff like Young would be part of the sheriff's core group of advisors? Well, that's why most courts, and increasingly more and more courts, are ruling that rank-and-file deputy sheriffs and sergeants are, in fact, not policymakers. But that doesn't help Terry Young. She doesn't have a job now, because in North Carolina, deputy sheriffs are still policymakers, and thus can be fired for political patronage reasons. Can I come back for a moment to my opening rant about police unions and the focus on their rights to exist? Do you think a police union might have impacted the way Deputy Terry Young's case was considered? Okay, I'm back off the rant. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this next case because the legal proposition that is at the core of it isn't really novel in this day and age, but it's really a good reminder to everybody. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, an employer has an obligation to reasonably accommodate an individual's disability. And there's a list in the ADA of the types of things that an employer has to consider in that reasonable accommodation process. The ADA describes a interactive process of working with the employee to identify potential reasonable accommodations and the like. One of the things listed in the ADA is the assignment to a vacant position. And the ADA also obligates an employer to at least consider an assignment that would involve modification of some job duties of the employee. For years and years after the ADA was passed, and by the way, it's been with us now, boy, about 25 years. For years and years, we had public safety employees, firefighters, corrections, law enforcement, making the argument that this reasonable accommodation obligation, you know, the potential modification of work duties or modification of a work shift, that this meant that public safety agencies had to have light duty jobs, or at least public safety agencies of any size had to have light duty jobs. Courts have been entirely unsympathetic to that argument. Courts have held very, very consistently that an employer, a public safety employer, has the right to insist that all positions be able to do the requirements of whatever the core job description is. For law enforcement, that means to be able to effectuate a forcible arrest. For the fire service, it means the ability to engage in suppression duties. And for corrections, it means the ability to control and manage inmates. And courts have said that there has to be the ability to mobilize, or I phrased that wrong, an employer has the right to insist that it be able to mobilize its entire workforce in case of emergencies, and therefore there's no obligation to have light duty jobs in public safety settings. That's what this case says. It's a a case that comes out of a federal court of appeals, the 11th Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, which pretty much always means it comes out of Florida. Not always. This comes out of Wakulla County, Florida. It's a corrections lieutenant by the name of Lisa Spears. Spears had cancer, and she underwent radiation therapy and had some very unpredictable health problems resulting from the both the cancer and the radiation therapy. She asked for a couple of accommodations that she thinks are reasonable, transferred to a different shift that would involve light duty work and would not involve shift work. In other words, she wouldn't have to work at night. And there were, you know, some jobs that were open where she could have done that. And also she asked for an extension of a leave of absence by using leave that would be donated by other employees. And the court ends up saying neither of those are reasonable accommodations under the ADA. The court holds that it would not have been reasonable for the sheriff to accommodate Spears by altering the detention deputy position to make it light duty and part-time or non-shift until she was cleared to return to full-duty work. We have held the ADA does not require an employer to reallocate job duties in order to change the essential functions of the job. And that's what Spears wants, says the court. She wants a job where she's not going to have to engage in the core duties of a corrections officer, and she's not going to have to engage in shift work. That's not a corrections officer's job, says the court, and there's no obligation to accommodate her. Now, mind you, the ADA, like all of these federal laws, the FMLA, the FLSA, that entire alphabet soup of federal laws, they only give us the minimum standards that exist in an employment setting. It's perfectly permissible to have a collective bargaining agreement that has greater protections for employees. In fact, you'd expect that to be in a collective bargaining agreement, right? Otherwise, why have it? So it may well be that what Spears wanted exists under your collective bargaining agreement. It may well be that a greater degree of accommodation for a condition that, in Spears' case, looked like it was going to be transient, that would be mandatory under your collective bargaining agreement. What this case says is it's not mandatory under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that's not just the law in the 11th Circuit. That's the law all over the country. There's one more case I'd like to talk about. It's kind of a continuing theme that we've had in some of these podcasts about what does binding arbitration mean? When is final and binding arbitration really final and binding? And you may recall, if you're a frequent listener to these podcasts, you may recall that the United States Supreme Court has really laid the groundwork for all this over a series of cases that go back many, many years. They go back to the early 1960s and the famous Steelworker trilogy of cases, three cases involving the Steelworkers Union and binding arbitration decided by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decisions continue right up to the most recent ones are in the last decade or so. And what the U.S. Supreme Court has said is that under the National Labor Relations Act, final and binding arbitration means just that. It means it's final and binding. There's only very, very narrow exceptions to it. There's an exception if the arbitrator's agreement is produced by fraud in some manner. Somebody's bribed the arbitrator. And there's a public policy exception if the arbitrator's order violates a clearly defined and explicit public policy. But those are rare, rare instances where that occurs. And almost the entire country follows that Supreme Court logic. There are challenges to arbitration decisions you see with a great deal of regularity around the country, and you see state courts interpreting state collective bargaining laws exactly the same way the Supreme Court interpreted the National Labor Relations Act, to say final and binding arbitration means final and binding arbitration, and don't come to us simply because you've lost. There's been a lot of focus in the last couple of years in law enforcement circles on Brady officers and final and binding arbitration. And this, these cases come up where you have a police officer who's discharged for untruthfulness. The arbitrator will look at the case and say, yeah, he or she was untruthful, but the conduct is not worthy of discharge. It might be a minor sort of untruthfulness, or maybe there are overriding mitigating circumstances, whatever it might be. And an arbitrator will put that person back to work. You'll see employers challenging those sorts of arbitration decisions and courts continuing to say, even with the weight of the Brady rule out there, final and binding arbitration means final and binding arbitration. But not in Rhode Island. As I mentioned, there are a few states that go a different route, march to the beat of a different drummer on this issue of binding arbitration, and so it has been for years and years in Rhode Island. I don't know why. I can't tell from reading the Rhode Island Supreme Court's decisions why that is the case. I don't know, but it is the case. This most recent case involves a corrections officer by the name of James Maddalena, and there's no question Maddalena violates the rules of his employer, which is the Rhode Island Department of Corrections. He's spotted smoking marijuana in a department vehicle while on duty, and when he's confronted about it, says, I didn't do it. He lies about what he did. I'm reminded, by the way, of a wonderful record album from the 1970s by a group called The Fugs. The title of it was Honest Officer. It crawled into my hand. And when I hear Maddalena's or I read Maddalena's explanation, it reminded me of that album title. Maddalena eventually tells the truth, but he's fired. And he's fired for both the untruthfulness and the smoking marijuana in the department vehicle while on duty. It goes to arbitration. He's represented by the Rhode Island Brotherhood of Corrections Officers. Goes to arbitration. An arbitrator overturns the discharge. Why? Because it seems there's pretty steady past practice for many years of treating employees just like Maddalena in a less harsh manner. And the arbitrator ends up looking at these prior disciplinary decisions and, you know, applies the rule of disparate treatment that's part and parcel of just cause and converts the discharge to a 60-day unpaid suspension. So about a $10,000 fine. It's a pretty substantial fine still. However, the state's not content with that, challenges the arbitrator's decision in the Rhode Island Supreme Court, and the court overturns the arbitrator's opinion and upholds Maddalena's firing. Now, I want you to listen to what the court has to say here, because it's really pretty fascinating, the court's logic. And then I'm going to take you back to the U.S. Supreme Court law and the law in the rest of the country on binding arbitration and analyze how this would apply there. Here's what the court says. The court says, look, the authority of an arbitrator isn't unbridled. An arbitrator has a duty to resolve a dispute based on the relevant provisions in a collective bargaining agreement, and the arbitrator's decision will be overturned if the arbitrator interprets a contract in a way that contravenes state law. Here, the arbitrator didn't resolve the dispute based on any provisions in the contract. In fact, the arbitrator decided that because the contract didn't list all offenses and corresponding penalties, because it didn't have a disciplinary matrix, that he would look to the broad principle of just cause for reference as to what would be appropriate punishment. Now, here comes the punchline in the court's opinion. The management rights section of the contract provides that the employer shall have the exclusive right to promote, transfer, assign, and retain employees and to suspend, demote, discharge, and take other disciplinary action against such employees. The arbitrator wholly overlooked this section of the contract. And because the arbitrator did so, it is an abuse of his powers, and his opinion must be overturned, and Maddalena's discharge upheld. Wait a minute, folks. That kind of shows a fundamental misunderstanding of a labor contract, doesn't it? The arbitrator was interpreting the contract. The arbitrator was interpreting the just cause provision of the contract and explicitly basing his decision on the just cause provision in the contract. That's what arbitrators are supposed to do. And in fact, there are two dissenting judges who write an opinion that I think you can fairly characterize as vigorous. They say the majority, and I'm quoting, completely misunderstands and misstates the role of an arbitrator. And I think that's right. I think what this court did was to look at these facts, smoking marijuana on duty in a company car and lying about it, and saying, we just fundamentally disagree with that result that that person should continue to be a corrections officer. We think the arbitrator got it wrong, and under Rhode Island law, we're entitled to say that. Now, how does this fare under U.S. Supreme Court decisions and the decisions in most states? The Supreme Court has said pretty much explicitly, an arbitrator can be wrong on the law and wrong on the facts, and we won't overturn the arbitrator's opinion. Why? Because that's what you bargain for, employer and union. When you bargain for final and binding arbitration, you know what? That means final and binding arbitration. You want courts to be able to freely review arbitrators' opinions, then you go bargain for that. Don't bargain for binding arbitration. If you do, you're going to be stuck with final and binding arbitration. So we have here a case that I think of as kind of sui generis. It's a one-off case, one of a series of one-off cases that we get from Rhode Island on the issue of binding arbitration. All right, that's it for our June 2015 podcast. We're going to be doing, hopefully, a couple of interviews over the course of the next month in cases. We're still trying to finalize that and make the arrangements with people. Particularly, we hope to do a pretty good reminder podcast interview with somebody who's an expert on sexual and racial harassment and employer policies in that area. That'll be fun. We've got our grievances and arbitration seminar coming up in September in Las Vegas, and we have a new seminar that we are doing, an advanced course in police discipline that we'll be holding in November. That too will be in Las Vegas. Go to LRIS.com for more information. In the meantime, have a good start to your summers. This is Will Aitchison signing off.